Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Republican-controlled Congress was in the news late on Monday with reports that the House had approved an amendment that would eliminate an independent ethics investigation office. By noon on Tuesday, Republicans had backed off the effort after President-elect Donald Trump had tweeted his disapproval. This hour, we're talking about what's next with the new session of Congress. Joining us now is Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Jessica Wehrman. Welcome back, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also, director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis, Stephen Smith. Professor Smith has authored or co-authored 6 books on congressional politics. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Jessica Wehrman, let's talk about the ethics issue first. There was no warning about that now aborted move. Why was that office targeted?
I mean, I think leadership had heard, actually, that were you asking why the office was started? Well,
we can talk about why the office was started, yeah. but why, I guess, why the opposition to it?
Well, so there was opposition to it because this was an office that was created in 2008, and it's supposed to be independent. It was created in the aftermath of just, I don't know if you remember, but there were a swath of scandals, including with Bob Ney, including the Jack Abramoff
former
scandal.
Ohio congressman with...
Ohio congressman who, got himself in a bit of trouble. But there have been complaints about this office over the years that it was a little overzealous, that it was run by very prosecutorial types. Now, traditionally, House ethics have been overseen by House members themselves, mm-hmm. which, as you can imagine, if you're a watchdog, you're going, oh, that's great. You're going to police your colleagues and your friends.
How'd that work for you?
Yeah. I mean, how's that going to go? So this office was created as a response to this, and there's been grumbling about it. In fact, I think Mel Watt, a Democrat, was the mm-hmm. last person to try to take on the office a couple years back. He tried to defund it. This time around, there was some warning, but it wasn't really warning that the public knew. I mean, I think leadership themselves knew that Congressman Goodlatte from Virginia kind of wanted to take this office on. However, this was the very first action that they essentially took in a closed-door meeting, which is, I mean, there's just like a lot of not ideal things about this if you're sort of an optics guy. This caused a huge outcry. Congressman, I mean, yesterday was supposed to be a kind of boring day, a very boring celebratory, yay, Congress, let's sing kumbaya before we get going kind of day. And it just turned out to be kind of a hot mess. So.
Yeah, let's talk about the symbolism, Stephen Smith, with that. How much does it matter? I saw a lot of videos of Vice President Biden doing the mock swearing-ins, but that's usually what it's about, right?
Well, that's right. And, of course, what the Republicans hope is that they can get a lot of attention for their new situation in Washington, for their new positive agenda, and for at least 8 or 10 hours on on Tuesday, that was all spoiled. And the other part of it is more than merely symbolic. This was a move to gut the Congressional Ethics Office by rank and file Republicans in opposition to what the Speaker and the Majority Leader wanted. Yeah. And they could not forestall this movement. And it looked like the next morning they were trying to rationalize it. And only when President-elect Trump stepped in did they call a conference meeting and reverse their position on it.
Yeah, Jessica Wehrman, what does that signal when House Republicans override their top leaders in voting to gut that office?
Oh, I mean, I don't know that it actually signals too much difference than what we've had in the past. I mean,
okay.
Boehner had a notorious problem with keeping his caucus in line. I mean, that was basically it's all very dramatic, and you have these folks who are trying to run this, and then you have some upstarts who kind of rebel. So in that respect, it's actually not very new. What is different this year is Republicans have every single prize. They've got the House, they've got the Senate, they've got the presidency. So in theory, they kind of wanted to start sort of looking like united and strong, and instead they've got this giant sort of mess to begin, which detracts from the whole idea like, don't worry, we're in charge now. We're going to take care of we're going to drain the swamp. House rank and file rebelling against leadership. I mean, you could argue that's why John Boehner left. But this is supposed to be sort of, you know, turning a page.
Right. Unified government. Stephen Smith, I mean, all Republicans in considerable control of every branch. What's the expectation that Congress will achieve? I mean, if they can't do it now, I guess the question is, can they ever?
Well, they're certainly going to be moving as quickly as they can on all their important agenda items. But let's keep in mind that the Republicans lost a very few seats in the House. They still control about 55% of the seats there. But they lost two seats in the Senate, and so their numbers are down to 52. That means that a loss of three Republicans on some of these key issues will take away their majority. So their control of the Senate is very, very marginal. And on regular legislation, the Senate Democrats can still filibuster. So on a wide range of items, they still can block Republican action. That is, in the absence of eight Democrats switching to support cloture and the Republican position. The Republicans are going to try to circumvent the filibuster, and they'll be able to do that, I think, by passing reconciliation measures that incorporate efforts to gut Obamacare, probably provide for tax cuts. And there may be one or two other major items that they can do through reconciliation, which is a procedure that allows a simple majority in the Senate to get to a final vote. But on things where reconciliation is not possible and they face the Senate filibuster, the Republicans will have their hands full. Nothing will be automatic.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the next congressional session. You just heard from Stephen Smith. He's director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis. Also with us, Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. Let's talk about Obamacare. Jessica Wehrman, the Affordable Care Act, it was supposed to be top of agenda. But what does it really mean when it comes to something of that magnitude getting repealed and replaced? It's not going to be quick.
No, it's not. And I think when you talk about, I mean, I think it's still top of agenda. If you would ask, if I were to walk across Capitol Hill today and ask Republican congressmen, but, you know, undoing this could become very, very complicated. This is a law that's now taken into effect. There are a lot of people who are receiving health care who weren't. So if they're going to undo it, it's not easy. It's not just, you know, sign a bill and you're done. And it's not sort of, how do I describe it? I guess uniform. I mean, there's a lot of different elements of it. So are we going to take away the pre-existing condition that you cannot, you know, I mean, are we taking away coverage for people up to 26 years old by their parent and do their parents' policies? So there's a lot to sort of take into account here. There's also sort of, you know, I mean, it's regardless of how popular or unpopular the law is, it's very hard to take things away from people who are used to getting something. So the earlier proposals I've heard have indicated that this is going to be a few years as to sort of take this, to put this in place, which I guess makes sense because it took a few years to implement the law in the first place. Interestingly, actually, Central Ohio has a lawmaker who's going to be very involved. Pat Tiberi is in charge of the Health Subcommittee, or he was last Congress. I haven't heard whether he's moving or not. So he might be one to kind of watch on this issue and see sort of how this actually goes into effect.
Mm. Stephen Smith, how do you measure something like a mandate? You made the salient point that, well, the House has been bolstered with Republicans. The Senate has not. I mean, what's the sense about what the voters, what the American public expects of Congress and how they're responding?
Well, mandates are a very funny thing, and probably the mandate this year is weaker than usual. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, the Republican president-elect won with fewer votes than his Democratic opponent. He's claiming a big mandate, but the mandate's relatively weak. The real challenge here is on healthcare. Obviously, is to find an alternative to the current law. Republicans have been in place for a long time and haven't been able to formulate an alternative that has rallied support from most Republicans. there are a number of proposals out there, but they really have not generated much interest, even among Republicans. What the Republicans have done so far is introduce a bill in the Senate that will force the committees of the House and the Senate to come up with plans to slash spending in the healthcare under the healthcare law, and they're expected to come up with that legislation by the end of January. So we're going to see very, very quickly here what kind of a strategy, repeal and replace or repeal and delay. And my guess is that repeal and delay is what we're headed for.
Yeah. Slash spending. Jessica Wehrman, why that? I mean, why is that such a priority? Obviously, the Republicans and they want to slash spending, but how? Where?
I mean, that's sort of a difficult thing. We may have to look at entitlements in terms of if you're cutting spending overall in the federal government, because we're, you know, in discretion, it's really down to the bone. A couple of years ago, you'll recall, we had the sequester legislation, which would have cut discretionary spending kind of across the board. And there was a huge outcry from Republicans who were related to armed services and military bases saying, this is actually going to put us at serious risk. You can't really cut the military beyond what you're cutting now, particularly at this time. So I think that that's going to be very difficult to actually – a lot of these ideas are great. I mean, these are like ideas that they've run on, but you know, when you're actually putting them into place, it's very difficult. Tax reform, I would say, is another one. That's something that is – you know, that's been talked about for years, but what does that look like? What can actually be agreed upon? I'm thinking, actually, when I was on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, somebody had one of my fellow correspondents had a funny little blurb on there. It's some sort of online clicking thing where it says, okay, you're in Congress, you want to vote for this, and then every single option was sort of a brick wall. I mean, actually doing these things is a completely different thing. Like, you know, for example, oh, I'm going to do gun control. Well, that's great, but you run into the gun lobby, you're out of the office. So actually doing these things and making them a reality is very, very difficult. So we'll see what kind of sweeping ideas actually turn into something.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's the prospect of working with someone, you know, working with Donald Trump. I mean, they already had struggles with obviously with President Obama, but what there's so many unknowns, Stephen Smith.
Yeah, exactly.
And Jessica Wehrman. I mean, with Donald Trump, how do they proceed, Stephen Smith, given the unknown factors in a Donald Trump presidency?
Well, it's very unclear to me. By this time, I normally would have expected a president-elect to have signaled what the top four or five priorities would
yeah.
be. And been working with members of Congress to fashion the critical details. But that's not happening here. You know, we might expect to see that at the time of the inauguration or a State of the Union address a few weeks later, that more detail would come from the White House than we've seen so far. But, you know, this was a presidential campaign on Donald Trump's part that focused on very few big issues, obviously trade and immigration and the wall, tax cuts, but it didn't go much deeper than that. And on most of even those items didn't provide consistent detail. So we have to wait. Now, members of Congress may not wait. Republicans have been running congressional committees now with fairly large staffs for a long time, and they've been piling up lots of ideas. In fact, the House has passed all kinds of legislation over the last couple of Congresses that's gone nowhere in the Senate. So they have a stockpile of policy ideas, many of which are inconsistent with what Donald Trump has said he would do. For example, he's promised not to touch Medicare and Social Security.
Right.
And yet many Republicans are dedicated to the proposition that these two largest federal programs really need to be reined in. He's also promised that people on Obamacare who have acquired private insurance will not lose that private insurance under any new plan he devises. But that's not the way many Republicans on Capitol Hill see it. So there are a great number of uncertainties about how things are going to go with this Congress and president.
We'll continue that conversation about the next Congress, how it works with the next president. That's Stephen Smith. He's director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis. Also with us, Jessica Wehrman. She's Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. We will be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the new session of Congress, which got off to a bumpy start this week after Republicans first voted for and then rescinded plans to dump the Office of Congressional Ethics. The controversial move distracted from what most believed would be a domestic issues-focused kickoff. Joining us is congressional scholar and director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis, Stephen Smith, also Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Jessica Wehrman. Jessica, I wanted to go back to Congress's relationship with President-elect Donald Trump. What kind of contact has the president-elect's administration to be had with congressional leaders? Stephen Smith said apparently not very much. What do you know?
Well, I know Mike Pence will actually be up on the Hill today, but it's more of a kind of a rah-rah, let's repeal Obamacare session from what I've read. I think Pence, you're going to see Pence really sort of taking a very active role in congressional relations between the new administration. But I think actually one of the more interesting developments of yesterday was how quickly congressional Republicans, that is, reversed themselves after it took two tweets from Donald Trump, just basically sort of expressing, saying this should not be our priorities before, you know, basically within an hour or two, they had reversed themselves. So, I mean, I read a headline that said, you know, he called him to heel. And I think that's actually a very appropriate way of saying, I mean, he sort of put him in order. So I don't know if this is sort of the new, I will be interested in watching, let's put it that way. I'll be interested in watching as things unfold to what degree he has some control over the Congress, because this is a very interesting party right now. I mean, there are a lot of just disparate parts, and so you know, you got Tea Party people, you've got Trump, who's not a Tea Party, but he's kind of something else. You've got the Chamber of Commerce. So how does this work out? I mean, it's so fragmented right now that I'm really, really fascinated in seeing.
Yeah, this. I mean, how Jessica, from where you sit, how often does he call them to heel before people start to wonder if there's a separation of powers?
Well, I that's exactly it. Now, we're just at the very beginning. He hasn't even taken the oath of office
right.
yet. So how does this unfold? These are I wish I could say how this is going, but everything about this is sort of rewriting the rule book. I used to be pretty good at prognosticating these things, and then Donald Trump happened. I mean, I was sitting there when I was listening to you and Dr. Smith talk earlier, and I thought, man, I kind of can't wait till the State of the Union. I just want to know, like, what's he going to say?
Yeah, you know, somebody sent me a note, Stephen Smith, and saying that I referred to Donald Trump as the likes of Donald Trump as if it was a pejorative. And it wasn't necessarily a pejorative. I mean, it wasn't. It was just the fact that he is such an unknown quantity. No matter how much he's lives life out loud, he's still an unknown quantity in this position, right?
Well, that's right. Jessica hit it the nail on the head there when she mentioned the role of Vice President-elect Pence. He's, of course, an experienced hand on Capitol Hill. And like some presidents in the past, Jimmy Carter comes to mind, you know, presidents can sometimes depend on the vice president to take charge of relations with Capitol Hill. In Donald Trump's case, we probably have a president who has less relevant experience for being a team leader for the congressional parties than we've ever seen before. And so I think he's going to be far more dependent on Pence, at least at the start. And exactly what kind of a one-two punch Pence and Trump will have, I'm not quite sure. But it could very well be that day-to-day activities from the White House will be organized and supervised by Pence, and that Trump is going to be there for, you know, special purposes, focusing on a few issues. and not really being a day-to-day player on Capitol Hill.
Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin had openly criticized Donald Trump during the election, and Donald Trump holds grudges. We do know that. What are the expectations, Jessica, that they can mend the necessary fences to move forward? Or will, again, you know, like Dr. Smith said, it's going to turn, you know, it's going to fall back to Pence?
At this point, and I keep saying at this point,
yeah,
I feel like
I'm
a bad predictor, but at this point, what I see is a kind of a pragmatic relationship. They will work with each other because they have to. Keep in mind, RNC, former RNC chair, Ryan Priebus, is one of the folks who's advising, who's one of, you know, he's the White House chief of staff, and he has a good relationship with Ryan. So I think it's going to be a pragmatic sort of deal-making relationship. The other point that I would make is, because the sense, the early sense that I get is that Trump is a delegator, meaning he's going to sort of have sort of sweeping broad ideas, but he's really going to let other people sort of take in charge with how that, take charge of how that's implemented. I think the bureaucracy becomes incredibly important, and his nominees become incredibly important during this administration. You know, I wrote a story about whether or not Jeff Sessions, who is a huge opponent of legalized marijuana, whether he would, what impact that would be. And I think that, you know, you're going to see a lot more potential impact from the bureaucrats within the administration, because I think that that that's going to be Trump's style, is to delegate, to let them, you know, sort of take the reins on their particular issues, and he'll just sort of, you know, support or oppose.
Trump's cabinet nominees must still be approved in the Senate. Do Democrats have anything much more than a bully pulpit? Even with that reduction in the numbers of Republicans in the Senate, Stephen Smith, do they have much more than a bully pulpit?
Not much more. It could be that one or two of the cabinet nominees will run into some trouble with Republicans, too. But my guess is that there'd be no more than one or two, and that virtually all of them will pass with, you know, nearly universal support among Republicans. The Democrats, of course, in 2013 got rid of the filibuster as a way to block nominations, and so a simple majority is all that's required. Still, technically speaking, the Democrats can filibuster. It's just that their filibuster can be broken with a simple majority. But that does mean that this complicated procedural device in the Senate, the cloture procedure, can still be used by Senate Democrats. And I think Senate Democrats are undecided at this moment about how much they're going to use that. If they use it for every nomination, they can delay action on each nomination for 2 or 3 days. And then across all the nominations, that can put it off, the confirmation process from being completed for probably a month, maybe even longer. So the Democrats can slow things down in the Senate and make it difficult for Senate Republicans to push their policy agenda very quickly by exploiting their procedural options on these nominations.
Jessica Wehrman, how does cloture work?
Well, cloture is it's a Senate procedure. So the House is pretty much everything goes by through a simple majority. With the Senate, you have to get is it 2/3? It's 60 votes basically to get through. Forgive me, I just sort of stumbled on the math there. This is where being a reporter is not. we're people.
Don't give away our secrets, Jessica.
I know exactly. Traditionally, exactly 3/5. There you go. Traditionally, you have to have 60 votes to really pass through things, such as this is where a lot of the nominees traditionally have gone through. Now, as Mr. Smith said, it's been, you know, this is, some of these rules have been weakened significantly. So, but that's actually, I mean, the Senate is supposed to be the thing that by the Constitution slows things down. The House gets things done, acts very rationally, and the Senate is supposed to be a little bit more measured in response.
Any sense how soon Donald Trump will nominate a replacement for Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court and put that before the Senate? Jessica?
I've not read anything on that yet. I mean, I think he's so busy filling the cabinet that I think that comes a little bit later.
Okay.
Now, I say that.
Yeah.
And probably jinxing it. But, you know, I think really right now the focus is on staffing up the administration.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what's ahead for the next Congress. They got started this week, a little bumpy, but maybe back on track at this point. You just heard from Jessica Wehrman. She's Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, and also with us, Stephen Smith. He's director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. Jessica, you wrote in late December that some Republicans in Congress were pushing to bring back earmarks, that is the port projects lawmakers can bestow on their districts. How has the absence of earmarks worked since they were banned in 2011?
So my sense on this is that basically a lot of the discipline that House leadership has been able to place on members has gone away along with earmarks. For example, you could say, well, I know you want that bridge in your district, Congressman, so you're going to vote my way and you'll get what you want. The complaint behind this, the theory behind this, and I don't think it's a completely invalid one, is that by getting rid of earmarks, Congress basically sort of negated or eliminated its own ability to control the power of the purse. They have appropriations bills, but they can't be very specific. Instead, they have to leave it up to the bureaucracy to choose, which, you know, I mean, for some Republicans, with the last administration, why would they want to give the Obama administration the opportunity to actually spend the money? Mm-hmm. So that's the theory behind it coming back. I don't know that it happens. They were very politically unpopular. You know, you talk about the ethics vote on Monday. I think that the earmarks would be similarly, there'd be a similar outcry because they were, at worst, really poor, really badly abused. The bridge to nowhere comes to mind.
Right.
But there are also places where they were pretty useful. I mean, there were places where a congressman could say, I've had this need in my district. It serves a national purpose. Here's what it is. And it wouldn't raise one single eyebrow.
But there were still some $4.2 million in earmarks doled out in 2015 compared to $29 billion in 2006. So proponents of earmarks, opponents of them say, look, it has saved money. We're not throwing money away on stuff that we don't need.
They're not, but that money is still getting spent. I mean, if you look at what's being spent nationally, it has not gone to significantly. It's just congressionally directed funding. And those earmarks are not really, it's not, I'm Congressman so-and-so, I'm putting this $1 million in for such. It's sort of a backdoor kind of thing.
Right.
Like Congress now, their way of doing this is, I'm going to have language in that really benefits. I mean, they have to be really smart about it and sort of say, you know, this language will benefit X, Y, and Z in such a way that it can't not be spent in their district.
Republicans have led the charge to return to earmarks. As I said, they say such a policy would bring about more transparency. Does this go to the issue of when the administration does it, they don't have to explain why they're doing it or what they're doing when they spend the money?
Yeah, I think that's basically the argument that we can, you know, we can, and there were databases and that sort of thing where you could look up earmarks and that kind of thing. But they basically say, well, now the bureaucracy says, well, such and such district is going to get this. There's very little explanation. There's very little oversight. That's the criticism. Now watchdogs are going to say, you know, this is really just sort of a way to pad your own district. This is a way to get reelected and to protect yourself. You know, John Boehner was an infamous foe of earmarks.
Which is surprising because Ohio was a big beneficiary of them.
And that's because of his neighbor, Dave Hobson,
right.
who retired. But he was, and also Ralph Regula up in northern Ohio, both were chairman of appropriations committee subcommittees. And over the years, you know, Ohio benefited quite a great deal from their largesse.
I always figured, though, it was because of Wright Patterson. Base there that it, obviously it was a huge government installation.
Yes, and it still benefits quite a bit, but there are other government installations that we don't think about. There's an Air Reserve Station in Youngstown, for example.
Okay.
There
Didn't
are defense installations. They're not active duty, right? Pat is the only active duty military installation, but there's also there are reserve and guard bases all over. I mean, even in Columbus, there are, you know, a lot of the accounting is done in, I think, Whitehall. So there are still, you know, we still have a federal purpose that, you know, could require earmarks, for example, or could require the bureaucracy to sort of make sure that we're taken care of. I know one of the fights they've had recently were over aircrafts in Youngstown to make sure we had the most up-and-coming aircrafts. I don't think it would be technically called an earmark, but you could say the delegation really fought very hard to make sure that Youngstown was taken care of.
Stephen Smith, you agree that things like earmarks, voters understand this like they do the ethics, Office of Ethics, and that independent office, that they do they want things like earmarks to be banned along with things like ethics offices to oversee what Congress is doing? Do they get that?
Well, they do, and they don't like what they get is that they don't like special influence, special favors, corruption to be making a major impact on public policy choices. But of course, earmarks never added up to a significant part of the budget.
No.
You know, if they got to be $20 or $25 billion at one point, you know, this next year's budget is likely to be $4 trillion. And so at its height, earmarks would have made up a very small fraction of the federal budget and contributed only a minuscule part to the deficit. You know, a case can be made that members of Congress make law, not bureaucrats. And so if members of Congress deem that a certain kind of project should be given priority, then they should have the right to write that into the law. I'm kind of a congressionalist on this. I think that there are times when members of Congress can make a case for a project that doesn't meet the technical requirements of the bureaucracy. And of course, we shouldn't pretend that the earmarking or that the parochialism of members of Congress has ended simply because of the ban on earmarks in congressional appropriations bills. These members of Congress are fighting for projects with the bureaucracy all the time. When the Democrats are in power in the White House, Democrats have an advantage in that process. And I expect Republicans will gain a big advantage in that process now when a Republican moves into the White House.
We'll continue our conversation about what's ahead for the U.S. Congress in 2017 in the next two-year session. That's Stephen Smith. He's director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis. And also Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the new session of Congress. There's lots of work ahead as Republican leaders in both chambers vow to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and the Senate forges ahead with confirmations of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominations. Still with us is Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, Jessica Wehrman, and also congressional scholar and director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis, Stephen Smith. Stephen Smith, is there anything that unites Democrats and Republicans in Congress right now? Trick question.
I'm going to have to give that a long. Well, in principle, there seems to be a commitment on the part of the incoming president and congressional Democrats to doing something substantial on infrastructure. It's not something that the congressional Republicans have given any emphasis to. Speaker Ryan has given it hardly any mention at all. And Senator McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, seems to think that they did enough in the last couple of years on infrastructure. So that's one area, I think, where Senator Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, and the incoming president might find some common ground. They've both at least given voice to a $1 trillion infrastructure commitment. But there's no details behind any of that. And I think we're a long way from knowing whether it's a meaningful area of common interest.
Jessica Wehrman?
Yeah, well, first of all, I apologize for giggling
no,
when
that's
you asked
okay.
that question.
Laugh out loud. Laugh fully. And...
I know. Yeah, you know what? I think Stephen is right. We talked about he talked about infrastructure, and he also talked.
We're
about
talking roads and bridges,
stuff.
That kind of
roads,
thing.
Bridges. But you know, I would add to that. In theory, tax reform is a sweeping idea that both. Now, when you get down to the nut of it, there's going to be some problems. But Republicans and Democrats agree that the tax code needs to be reformed. That it's really punishing to business owners. It actually encourages them to move jobs overseas. So I think in theory, that's another one I would add. And I also want to add this provision. Sometimes Trump actually agrees with Democrats where Republicans don't necessarily agree with him. I'm thinking of trade policy. I cover Sherrod Brown, who mm-hmm. is very concerned about a lot of the trade agreements we have, and so is the president-elect. So there might actually be common ground between the administration and some Democrats, and Republicans aren't necessarily universally lockstep on that issue. They're not necessarily as freaked out about trade as Senator Brown is.
Exactly. They're not. They tend to be exactly the opposite about it. They support the trade agreements.
Yeah, they do. Well, in general, they have. Yeah, now,
in general.
Again, things are sort of in flux with the party right now. Because, I mean, are they going to follow the president-elect on this issue, or are they going to kind of stick with where they have been traditionally? So.
Yeah, I think Jessica's right. That's an issue that's going to be potentially interesting. Just this morning, Speaker Ryan said that Congress would not be raising any tariffs. So that, I think, threw a bit of a wrench into the discussion generated over the last couple of days about auto plants moving to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are serious differences between Trump and traditional Republicans on trade. Democrats, of course, don't like some of these trade agreements, but for some of the same reasons that Trump dislikes them, that is the effect on the American worker. But Democrats go beyond that. There are many Democrats who don't like trade agreements because of their environmental implications, and I don't think Trump shares any of those concerns.
Or human rights implications, too,
yeah. Or human rights, right. So it's a very complicated issue, and it's hard to see how much real change is going to occur here.
Right. Donald Trump, in the last few days, has criticized, is it GM? For its crew, one of its cars, it said like something like 4,500 of them are sold in the United States. He said they would impose tariffs on that. Congress has to do that, right, Jessica?
Yeah, I believe so, actually. Yeah. And I think he's talking about the Chevy Cruze, which
Chevy.
It's built in Lordstown. Am I right? I mean,
well, most of them are. Yeah.
Yeah, the vast majority are. So, yeah, I believe Congress is the one who has to actually implement that. Now, yeah, with the trade office can do is sort of help make sure that the trade agreements are enforced, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Jessica's right. I mean, this is a matter of effectively American law. When we ratified the NAFTA agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement, we put in place what was effectively new American law about what these tariffs will be, and they cannot be unilaterally changed by a president. There are some tariffs that can be changed unilaterally, but that's one thing, the imposition of a new tax on imports from Mexico, that the president would not be able to do on his own.
Donald Trump devoted a lot of campaign attention to his vow to build a wall along the Mexican border, paid for by the citizens of Mexico. What are the expectations of Congress in this regard, Jessica Wehrman? I mean, is anything going to happen? I mean, we've already heard all of the step-down conversations that, well, he says he's going to be hard on immigration, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of people are still counting on that wall.
They are. This is such it was a cornerstone of his campaign, was we're going to build a wall. That's what people chanted at the rallies, mm-hmm. build the wall. But I don't really, I mean, I've been kind of searching and looking a little bit to find ways in which U.S. presidents can force other countries unilaterally to build a wall. And I haven't figured out how that's possible. Now,
right.
I'm willing to accept. I may be wrong on that one. But you would have to actually have Congress, I think, build the wall, which means we would have to pay for it. That's the only way I see that actually becoming a reality. And there has been a discussion for years. There's always been discussions, mm-hmm. as long as I can remember, about building some sort of wall. I haven't been to the southern border lately. I don't know what degree there is an actual wall existing. But, I mean, this wasn't a new thing that he created when he talked about building the wall. I mean, this is something that's been talked about for years.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen Smith, I mean, Congress, actually building a wall It's ridiculously expensive.
Yeah. Well, in fact, Trump, to his credit, I guess we put it that way, has, you know, softened his view even during the campaign, saying, well, it might be partly a fence, it might be partly electronic. And so on. But it has to be much stronger and it's got to be tall, and the Mexicans are going to pay for it. So because the Mexicans are going to pay for it, it would not have any budget consequences for the United States. And we would not. But of course, we haven't heard any plans about how Mexico is going to do that. You know, presumably he was going to put some pressure on Mexico by putting some restrictions on money going from Mexicans in the United States back home, and put the squeeze on the Mexican government. But I think that's highly unrealistic, and it would require some congressional action. He's not going to get that.
Congress can reverse many of President Obama's regulations, but does it take the next president to reverse his executive orders? Is there a difference? Who gets to do what? Stephen Smith?
Well, Congress, by passing new legislation, can reverse executive orders as long as those executive orders do not emanate from the president's independent constitutional powers. Some do, most don't. They can reverse any rule or regulation issued by an executive department or agency by changing the underlying statute that supports that rule or regulation. And so we're going to see a lot of action on the part of Congress to do just that. For rules and regulations that were put in place over the last couple of months, Congress can take advantage of the Congressional Review Act, which gives it the right to reverse a regulation within 60 days. So these last-minute things that the administration or agencies do in the form of rules or regulations can be reversed by Congress. And Congress is eager. The Republicans have long advocated something called the REINS Act, R-E-I-N-S, which would require that any major rule or regulation be approved by Congress before it is implemented. Now, that's not the current law, but many Republicans advocate it, and Trump says he will support it if Congress enacts it.
He would support giving away power, presidential power.
Well, that's kind of a dubious proposition, but during the campaign, he
said he did. You know, Jessica Wehrman, I get the feeling that there's probably some people who have been assigned to tag and eliminate as many Obama or Obama administration regulations and executive orders as possible. I mean, are there people just working on that?
Well, I know that Congress, there are members of Congress who have been working on that for quite a while. And Bob Gibbs, who is another Ohio congressman, that's a big part of what he does is look at EPA, look at regulatory. He has a farming background, so he looks at farming policy, and that has been a centerpiece of what he has worked on. And I think it's pretty safe to say you can expect him to work on that this time. The difference is, in theory, this could pass the Senate and go to the White House now, some of these things that he works on, looking at sort of, I guess, regulatory sort of overkill, really, I mean, rules that sort of, whether or not how they're intended is one thing, but how they actually go into effect is really very debilitating for business owners. That's his argument.
Well, they're going to have to make that case, though, now, instead of...
They are.
Because, once again, you mentioned earlier, taking stuff away is different than instituting
something.
But
it's easier to take away a rule that restricts people than, like, stuff that, you know, for example, a rule that you can argue restricts people, it wouldn't necessarily restrict you if you're looking for clean air or clean water, that, as opposed to, like, here's your health care. I think you could probably, it's a little bit easier for people to absorb, perhaps.
So I guess the environmental lobby is girding its loins at this point?
They are, really. And, you know, EPA, folks who have worked on this for years under Gina McCarthy are going, okay, what can we expect now? What is this going to mean for us? So, you know, they've been working on clean water regulations, on clean air regulations, and the question is, well, what happens to these now? Because for every one of those regulations, you've got someone like Gibbs who's saying, well, you know, but this hurts so-and-so.
Is there a calculated risk, Stephen Smith, in Congress sort of trying to undo the previous administration?
The Republicans could easily overreach They probably can do quite a few things that most of us would consider to be very conservative and make their constituencies, their home constituencies, happy. But maintaining their majorities in Congress, winning the next presidential election, requires appealing to middle-of-the-road voters. They could easily move too far to the right in gutting popular education programs, popular environmental programs, popular consumer protection programs, popular civil rights, voting rights programs, and maybe even take on Social Security and Medicare, and then be considered to be far, far too conservative to deserve maintaining their majorities in Congress or controlling the White House. So there is some discretion that's required on the part of the Republicans. They probably should not do everything they technically could do and would want to do, in part because of their interest in maintaining their majorities over the longer term. But this is what creates strategic conflicts among Republicans. Some say we have to move when we can. This is our chance to strike. Let's go now. Who knows what the future holds? Others will say, no, we have to think about the long term. We can't predict what policy needs the country will have in the future. We want to be in the majority when we get to that point. And so the trade-offs between their policy wishes and their electoral needs will be a pretty serious challenge, I think, for Republican leaders in Congress over the next 2 years.
And ultimately, Jessica Wehrman, especially in the Senate, you could lose some moderate, whatever few there are left there, moderate Republican votes on certain issues, right? You could alienate them on, for instance, if you want to take away the funding for Planned Parenthood in the Affordable Care Act or anything, birth control coverage, you could alienate.
You could. At this point, remember, folks have to answer their constituents at the end of the day, and they have to be able to preserve. Job preservation is such a motivating factor in life, right? We have lost a lot of those swing votes in recent years in the Senate, so it's a much more conservative body than it has been. That said, there are still people who are in swing states, who are in tight states, who have watched some of their colleagues lose because they voted the wrong way on certain issues, perhaps last November. And they're going to they're going to be watching that.
This Thursday, the Senate Armed Services Committee holds the first public hearing on the intelligence community's assessment that Russia interfered in the U.S. election. Does this issue have real legs in Congress, Stephen Smith?
Well, it does. And I think in part because President-elect Donald Trump has cast doubt on what we've learned through the administration about the intelligence community's views about hacking by the Russians. In this case, John McCain, the leader of the Senate Armed Services Committee, is pursuing this on his own, when his own leader, Mitch McConnell, would prefer to have the Intelligence Committee handle this, I think, in a more quiet way. But McCain is not going to let the issue die. He's very anti-Russian, very pro-defense, and I think he's going to push this issue as far as it can go.
Jessica Wehrman, what do you make of that?
I mean, this is where the Senate gets very interesting, because you do find people like McCain who aren't necessarily willing to toe the party line, which actually the party line used to really be
what John McCain says. Yeah, right, right.
He's sort of a traditionalist in this front. So if you have individuals like McCain who are strong senators, who are impactful and influential, then it's not going to die. I mean, I think Trump would like to just sort of see it go away, but I think that there are going to be voices within the Senate that are powerful enough to kind of keep it going. You know, when you've got a Republican senator bucking his president on this issue, then it's worth note.
A Republican senator who is just reelected to another, term, probably his last, and nothing to lose.
No, nothing at all.
Right. Jessica, have I left anything out that you want to mention as far as what's ahead for Congress this year? Just got about a minute left.
Oh, well, I definitely would say let's look at tax reform. Let's see what happens with the Obamacare repeal or replace, where that goes, and the regulations. I mean, those are the top three things that I think I'm going to be keeping an eye on as Congress gets to work. And also, will they be able to do anything? Does this make a difference that you have everyone in the same party? There are so many divisions within the Republicans alone that, it's an unknown. It's still a question mark.
Well, Jessica Wehrman, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time, as always.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Stephen Smith, thanks to you as well. Appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Stephen Smith is director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University in St. Louis. And Jessica Wehrman is Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.